You're listening to Power from the Margins, 3CR's Disability Day broadcast. Welcome to Ableism in the Settler Colony. Later in this program, you'll hear from Dominic Golding on the research project he conducted on refugees with disabilities in Colony Australia, as well as interviews with an ex-detainee of colour and a refugee of colour with disabilities. Right now, here's an interview with Latoya Aroha-Rule on the intersection of race and disability in Australia's prison system.
So my name's Latoya Aroha-Rule. I'm a Wiradjuri Māori person living on Kaurna land in South Australia, Adelaide. I do a lot of campaign work, I would say. So I identify as an activist scholar. So I do a bit of writing around Aboriginal deaths in custody, but also campaigning, particularly over the last 3 years on this issue after the death in custody of my own brother, Wayne Fellow Morrison, here in South Australia. So what we know at the moment, with some statistics done by a friend of mine, Jerry Georgiou from Western Australia, we know that 1 in 5 Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander women are incarcerated at the moment, and that's 1 in 7 for Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander men, which is like literally some of the highest incarceration rates in the world for Aboriginal people. As we also know, you know, a lot of those psychosocial or cognitive disabilities. So when we talk about, say, like reporting, for instance, we know that, you know, there's always an insufficient amount of reporting and research that actually captures people with disabilities because of the wide range of what that actually looks like. But there's been a few reports done. One by the Human Rights Watch Committee found such a high level and rate of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in prison have multiple disabilities that aren't being captured by the particular data that we need to be capturing these in. And we only see the outcomes of these high statistics and these rates when people are subjected to different oppressions in prisons and where their healthcare needs aren't taken seriously. So yeah, in terms of statistics, we are the most incarcerated people in the world right now.
I think I first heard you speak at Imagining Abolition last year, which was the conference that Sisters Inside put together. At that conference, there was one session that specifically at the intersection of, it was basically a clinical psychologist, a white clinical psychologist actually, who was talking about disability and youth justice. That was the name of the session, I believe. And I went to it, and it was a 20-minute talk on how, from the get-go, kids sort of labelled problem children because they have undiagnosed disabilities wind up in youth incarceration, and from then on it's just basically a lifetime in the system. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about young Aboriginal people in youth incarceration.
Yeah, so particularly for young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, our young peoples actually, for, at least in the Northern Territory at the moment, make up 100% of all youth peoples in prison. So there's not one non-Aboriginal person at all locked up at the moment in the Northern Territory. We know that there's obviously huge rates, particularly right now for the New South Wales and Victoria, being incarcerated. Some reporting has come out through Amnesty International with their Communities is Everything campaign. There's a few other Human Rights Watch communities and the Human Rights Legal Centre that is, you know, publishing on youth incarceration. If we can remember the Don Dale incident, we've had particular images being released to us of Aboriginal young people, you know, in spit hoods and really being tortured in these places of imprisonment as well. And, you know, while we're talking about disability, our young people are actually leaving prisons, and all peoples are really are leaving prisons because of the violent nature of what they do to people. So they're actually leaving prisons with kind of these new issues, I guess you can say. But that's not only that they're leaving into things like homelessness and poverty, but they're leaving traumatized. They're leaving, you know, after being beaten and bashed by corrections and police while, you know, they spent time inside. So we have to consider the fact that, you know, health needs aren't being met inside, but they're actually coming out with even more health concerns. And that's just not what the state sends people away for. We don't expect people to be injured and harmed during their time incarcerated, but we do know that these are the most violent spaces particularly for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and people of colour and black people, that exist right now in our society, if not in, you know, the common day surveillancing of us in everyday society. We also know that people with disabilities are particularly kept in places of solitary confinement for not abiding by rules and regulations of the prison system. We know there's an overrepresentation of being locked up in these, in fucking captivity, to be honest. That's what solitary confinement is. The dehumanization that I'm talking about, this is something that relates back to colonization. You know, it's particularly just an ongoing systemic issue of racism for people who are already facing those oppressions and injustice and inequalities that's heightened in places like prisons and police cells. So at the moment in South Australia, thankfully through people like Connie Benaros from SA Best, you know, political team in SA Parliament, she's been able to push a new bill in Parliament to actually ban all spit hoods in places of youth imprisonment across South Australia, which would actually make us nationwide in the colony of Australia to completely ban all spit hoods in all places of youth detention. So South Australia is the last one to do that. But we know that those still exist, and in particular restraints still exist in adult prisons. So I will hopefully next year be beginning to build that campaign further to look at adults. There's some really strong players across Australia who are really keen to look at those restraints, because we know, and when I say restraints, I'm not just, you know, talking about physical restraints through different like mechanisms, but I'm talking about procedures of restraint as well. So in my brother's case, we've heard evidence and we've seen evidence of corrections officers using their force of their body to restrain my brother. So they fell on him twice. One particular corrections officer, sorry, when I say fell, I mean purposefully used their body weight to restrain an individual. And, you know, there were over 14 corrections officers involved in that restraint, 7 in the van. So when they pulled Wayne out, he was unconscious. Those aspects are really important for us to be looking into, because they coincide with other deaths in custody, but also just other complaints, you know, where people have nearly lost their lives and have been hospitalised in prisons because of these types of restraints and mechanisms used. They're very dangerous, and it's, you know, a form of torture, and that's in a lot of ways how it's been called out. In terms of healthcare in prisons, we know that particularly for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, again, there's no culturally appropriative healthcare. So there's not Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nurses or medical staff, you know, in the prisons much at all. Can I just also say, for trans and non-binary people, there's an insufficient amount of research being done. So I can't even say for those groups what kind of healthcare needs, or thinking about disability as well, what kind of access they're receiving, because we know that today there are still trans women in men's prisons, for instance. And so we know that in terms of getting access to, you know, what they need to stay healthy, to stay sane, and you know, for their social and emotional well-being, they're not actually receiving that healthcare. And so, yeah, in terms of healthcare, there's a huge issue as well for people who already have things that they need monitored. If we can think about one example that I have of this, is actually one of my friends gave me a call last year when her father was taken from prison, and he actually had cancer in prison, and he fell over in his cell and they didn't know why. He was rushed to hospital and the family actually weren't notified for 2 days, and they were actually accidentally notified. So South Australia has a policy where the family aren't to be notified until 7 days if that person is even in hospital. So we think about people in prisons with disabilities, their families may not even be told or notified that they're actually, you know, aren't receiving the access to healthcare that they need and the advocacy that they need. And then we know that by the time that might happen, if they stay that long in hospital or for their care, you know, sometimes it's too late. This is something that I'm really passionate about, and something that needs to change. these are issues that just like aren't being spoken about either. So it's really important that we do that now. The fact is that, you know, the colonial state will never dismantle itself. And so it's not going to give up money to put into research on these really particular issues that focus mainly around Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, Black, POC, trans, non-binary individuals in prison, because at the end of the day, that doesn't really affect colonial project and its continuation, you know? And so it's really hard to find the resources to do this research in the first instance. And then the people that are doing them, we know that majority of those are white, you know, great allies, a lot of them, but it's still just insufficient. Like, we need the resources to be doing this work ourselves.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Ableism in the Settler Colony, 3CR's Disability Day broadcast. Next up, here's Dominic Golding, the Ability Rights Coordinator at RISE Refugee Survivors and Ex-Detainees. Last year, he released an advocacy report titled Ex-Detainees, Asylum Seekers and Refugees with Disabilities, Our Needs and Perception of Disability. He spoke to Mario Pizzega about this and systemic barriers that refugees and asylum seekers with disabilities face.
I have two disabilities and I'm of a Vietnamese background. I have a good experience of the disability sector. And what has happened over that time is that a number of our members have come forward requesting support around their disabilities. Mm-hmm. So I kind of naturally grew out of that.
Yeah.
And so we've kind of developed a support program, not in the sense of like a case management work, but in a sense of trying to find linkages and services available for asylum seekers and refugees. But through that, what I encountered was that a lot of information that's not available are known by both the disability sector and by the refugee sector. Mm. And I was kind of puzzled by that because I worked in the community sector for the last 17 years, mainly around refugees and migrants. And I just thought, oh, that's just really interesting. So even though I've grown up in Australia, I have two disabilities, so I have a hearing impairment as well as mild cerebral palsy. Mm. So I kind of know the sector quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the questions I asked is about where can I get support? Who can I talk to? Mm. What access do I have?
Mm.
And a lot of the time when I went out to look for certain services, mainstream services, to get accurate information about eligibility and accessibility was just amazingly difficult. So you can go on all these different websites. Mm. A, they're all in English. That's the first barrier.
Mm.
And number two, to find the relevant information, you have to go through several different pages of the website in order to find what you need. And it's like, well, I'm English speaker literate, and if it's difficult for me, it must be quite difficult for recently arrived. The lived experience of our members is vital to how we deliver our services. And it's also vital to how our self-advocacy works at RISE. So, because it's driven by our own lived experience, the services are try to be as open and accessible as possible, but also so that the members of the board are also of that background. On that basis of support and getting the funding support, we rely mainly on donations from the refugee community. But also we make a political stance that because of the government's role in perpetuating not only mental health issues but also disability issues for our members who are in detention or just out of detention.
Yeah.
So we believe we should not take money from the federal government. So we kind of take that stance when it comes to developing our support services and advocacy in that space.
it's a big difference to, say, other organisations that are in the refugee sector who haven't kind of centred that lived experience as much and involved people who actually are asylum seekers and refugees.
Yes, I would agree with that. That's mainly because no fault of their own, but you're operating, those services operate within a mainstream perimeter. So it basically is really about delivering a service that generally comes from a universal, equitable position. It's actually not a catering to what you would think would be the denominator group that you're servicing.
Yeah.
So we tend to take the opposite view, which is I experienced a concern in the community and a barrier. I will develop a service to help directly support that. An example would be we have quite a few different services. So we have a library, which is freely accessible, but it's stocked by texts and books by people of colour. But mainly most of our work is advocacy, and the other lot of our work is legal advocacy, so case work around the tribunal.
So that brings me to the report that you wrote. It's called Ex-Detainees, Asylum Seekers and Refugees with Disabilities, Our Needs and Perceptions of Disability. So you've kind of already talked about why this is important. Can you talk us through the process of how this report came about?
Yeah, this report came about from my engagement with funding bodies. And the principal question that we got feedback from those funding bodies was that, where's the information, where's the data around refugees with disabilities? And we went, okay, so just having anecdotal evidence from our members was not enough. We needed to come up with a more concrete, conclusive basis of why a service is needed, particularly for this cohort, which is refugees and asylum seekers with disabilities. So I had the opportunity to do the Social Equity Institute Fellowship at Melbourne Uni. That allowed me access to the resources and two mentors from the sector, one in the disability sector, one in the refugee sector. And I started out with a literature review, and then I incorporated what I call a unstructured, semi-structured interview process with our members to kind of see whether how much of the information that's out there in relation to the experiences of our members. So try and match them together. So it's really aimed at refugee organisations, migrant resource centres, health clinics and health services, and disability services. So they get an understanding of if any of their clients of a refugee background and has a disability, they kind of have a bit of a base understanding of some of the complexities of coming to a country newly arrived and with a disability.
When I was reading it, I was thinking this is really good for just mainstream community services, right? Because often they don't come in contact with people who are refugees and newly arrived. And I think you were talking before about funding bodies, and funding bodies can sometimes be very siloed in kind of the way they fund, and then services also become really siloed. And I know that's something you wrote in your report. So can you talk to me a little bit about the silos and how actually that gets enacted when people try and access supports?
So the silo approach has really come, what I believe, came out of the medical model. So disability was seen traditionally as from a dysfunction of one's body and that's an impairment. So our way of looking at disability was, in a sense, developed on how do you fix that? So that's one silo. And there's a lot of literature, a lot of work around how that is compared to the social model of our disability. But the refugee end of it, it really comes out of border crossing, the literature around legal status of being a refugee and what you need to prove to be a refugee, which is about persecution.
Mm.
And what was really interesting was that I found that none of the disability literature and the refugee sector literature actually communicated both intersectionality-wise. So there was very little information from the refugees about experiences of disability and what that means. And I found that really strange because generally most refugees come from conflict zones. And what happens in conflict zones? People get shot at, they're bombed, they're fleeing burning villages and towns and so forth. Generally, that creates disability.
Yes.
But the disability sector really comes more out of a community activist stance from the 1960s and 70s, but mainly from the 1970s, and the domestic advocacy. So it's out of institutions from the medical model into the community. So the disability sector literature was really about how do you get equality, how do you get fair treatment, how do you challenge the idea of the medical and moving it into the social model. But what they don't talk about is minority groups, what we like to call people of colour or migrants.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the literature from the disability sector is Anglo-Saxon mainstream, which is where it comes from. So what was interesting about the disability is that the only aspect of disability that looks as close to the refugee area was veterans, war veterans, and the history of war veterans advocating for better support services for their disability. So I kind of tried to bridge those two together.
Another barrier that you highlight in your report is that refugees who arrive on humanitarian grounds and asylum seekers are granted different visas. So the visas, depending on what visa you're on, is actually also dependent on what services you can access. Can you talk a bit about that?
That's a very complex one because visas are purposely built to be complex.
They are.
So to unpack it as simply as I can, if you're a refugee, you can come into Australia on a humanitarian entrance visa, you're automatically given permanent residency. This gives you access to all the mainstream services, disability services, plus Medicare. Or the bridging visas, TBV and SHEV visas, only give you access to Medicare, and that's restricted on what kind of services there are. Medicare is not disability support services. And that's why I try to make clear in the report that those who are asylum seekers have an additional barrier, and when they have a disability, there's more barriers to encounter. So if you have a hearing impairment and you're an asylum seeker, you cannot always get hearing aids from the mainstream hearing audiologist in Australia. But also you're locked out of one principal defining act of reform that's currently happening, which is the NDIS, which is only available for those who are on her permanent residence. So that's where it gets a bit complicated, to try to separate the visas as well as the different classes and what you're eligible for.
The way you've explained it is there's a whole bunch of people that actually can't have access to any services or any help in the community. So going back to the silos you were talking about before and how there's no communication between the different kind of, you know, sectors and things like that. One of the things that you wrote about in your report, which I thought was really interesting, was that often services don't ask the question about disability and, you know, ask about whether people are needing support for that. So can you talk a bit about that and why you think that it's not being talked about when people are coming in contact with services, particularly settlement services?
Well, that comes from a long, long, long history of migration support and settlement in Australia. Migration support is really based on a certain narrow idea of Maslow's hierarchy of need. So the refugee sector and settlement has focused on those sort of thing. They have not considered disability. That's kind of like later down the track, or if a family member has a disability, we'll deal with that later. So that's why settlement has not really dealt with disability well. And also one of the main things is that because they don't ask about disability, it's not addressed. So if you've got a client that comes in through the door for intake and you don't ask about disability, they're not going to answer about their disability.
Yes, that's right. This show, we talk a lot about kind of invisible illness as well and invisible disabilities. So it's even less likely that people are services are going to pick up on that, right, unless they ask the question.
What is really interesting, though, is that when from feedback from RIDE members is that if you present to the refugee support or settlement service clearly with a visible physical disability or intellectual disability, they're more on top of things when it comes to getting that support services available for you in the community. But if you present with, which a lot of refugees have, which is invisible disabilities, then you're less likely to get the support you need. Now, this has been example like shrapnel injury, torture injury, bad back injury, acquired brain injury because of torture and trauma or bombs going off and because you're being shot at. Not every bullet, you know, causes it a deformed impairment or disability, but it's a disability that affects you 24/7. So it might decrease your limits, your limitations to be able to do things. So getting those supports and justifying it is a lot harder.
In the report, there was also kind of some quotes from people who you had interviewed just around their perceptions of disability and what that actually means for them and for their communities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that came about with my investigation into the literature of both refugees and disability sector. And I thought, well, hang on, we've got to rewind a little bit. Have we actually asked newly arrived refugees and asylum seekers what the term disability means for them? Mainly because the mainstream disability services in Australia presents disability to the public. If you want to get support, you must get your disability addressed by this organisation. And that's quite confronting for newly arrived people. So it's like, whoa, what does this mean? Because English is as a second or third or even a fourth language. And also, well, back in my language or country of origin, that does not make sense. For many people, they come from countries where disabilities and having a disability is still looked down upon. Or the support required to address that disability, it's not going to come from government, it's going to come from the community. For example, in one language, there is no word for disability, but it's a specific different types of impairments. And in another language, disability, the way we describe disability, when it's translated, is a negative.
Yeah.
So the negative is reinforced when they come to Australia and they see the services that are available for them.
We've talked a lot about all the gaps that there is. Dominic, what do we do about it?
This report kind of, and what I came out with is kind of an overall analysis of how systems are working.
Yeah.
And I put it, one needs to work within those systems. So we've got the structures available, but we need to be more proactive as mainstream service providers to do the right thing as you would an Australian citizen.
Yeah.
Just because you're newly arrived or don't speak English or may not know a full translated document from the services, you need to actually take the initiative and be active about how they get the support that they need.
Yeah.
If you go to the GP, you get your initial health assessment. One should need, the doctor should ask about disability there in order to get the referral required. Mm. So that's kind of what I'm kind of getting at.
Yeah. I feel like mainstream services saying, I don't know, is just not good enough. And I think it's up to mainstream services to reform, to change their approach and not rely on organisations like yours to kind of fill that gap for them.
In some ways, this report was kind of like throwing out a bit of bait to them. So, and also, well, kind of encouraged the organisation to do their homework after reading it.
So yes.
It wasn't meant to be a comprehensive thesis on refugees with disabilities.
Yeah.
It's more to encourage internal reform in the process of how you give the support to your clients.
You're listening to Power from the Margins, 3CR's Disability Day broadcast. I had the honour of speaking with an ex-detainee who wishes not to be named for this program. Here is his story.
I am an ex-detainee who came to Australia seeking asylum, got detained. I was there like 30 months. That was here in Melbourne. To my great shock, I never saw anything like that in my past life, particularly from the countries they beat drums of that they are the champions of human rights, and they sometimes believe that they have got right to impose their will on poorer or the countries which are far from Australia. Whether it be Britain or United States of America, wherever they believe to go for some adventures or misadventures for their political or commercial gains, they go and wage wars. The biggest thing which is lacking in the argument or refugee or asylum seekers debate worldwide is who are these people seeking asylum or the stateless? There is a lot of noise is made that it is complicated, the number of asylum seekers is staggering, there are more than these million people. Australia can't accept refugees, hold refugees. What I have always said, the countries who they are voluntarily signatory to the Refugee Convention, which gives asylum seekers or the people who they are fleeing for the convention reason, the signatory countries have got an obligation to accept them. The biggest contradiction for me is this, that the countries who they are signatory to the Refugee Convention, they go into the war, the countries sometime 12,000-15,000 kilometres away from Australia, knowing that there'll be millions of people be killed, injured, and forced out of their homelands. And then those very countries are reluctant to accept refugees which are caused, pushed, forced by taking part into the war. And when they come here, I mean, we're still, one little point I wanted to raise is, we are signatory to that treaty. And that treaty, that document of United Nations, if you read, that's not changed. What has changed is Australia's internal laws, how to implement, interpret, and accept refugees. That's the biggest hypocrisy. I always believe if Australia cannot accept or have capacity to accept refugees, they should, number one, should not go into the wars, believing the clear-cut understanding. Any layman would understand. If you go to war, people will be killed, be injured, or forced out of their homelands or countries. So knowing this, that people will flee, knowing that we are still signatory, and then not to accept people and put them into detention centers, sometime 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. In one of the Australian High Court's decision, it was said that it is legal to detain people, even if that means that the detained people will remain there for the rest of their lives. Well, if we reach there and then we see we are signatory, and then we're signatory to United Nations human rights, you know, articles or the sections, I will forget if I'll, but there are like section 9, section 7 or 8. So a lot of things we are in violation in that area. And when people come here, now coming back, you know, to your original question, I walked into detention center physically and psychologically fit person, have no problems. I worked in construction industry as civil engineer for 27 years prior to coming to Australia. Had no problems. But soon after arriving here, I started having back pains, crippling back pains. I was openly said that I'm putting it on to gain sympathy or something. I was helped by people to take me to even to my essentials, to go to the toilets or take showers or put some chair there. Or I was denied wheelchair I needed. And when I was, you know, I would crawl on the floor. So I was openly, even then, told I'm putting it on. There used to be a doctor who would come maybe once or twice a week for a few hours. And you will be only able to see a doctor if the nurse believes that a doctor should see me or see the sick person. So I've been through that hell. And I did apply bridging visas on health grounds, was denied. So I was there for 30 months. So my condition got worsened. So there were four L discs, lower discs were infringing on my spinal cord or giving me havoc in a way that I wasn't able to use my legs to walk or things like that. And then I had three discs in my neck in C-section. And my mental health got deteriorated too. We were writing and asking, begging people outside. We started asking people to come and visit us. In a way, people were not visiting. People need to know in a country or city like Melbourne, there are people incarcerated. Through our visitors, we started questioning and asking, started interviewing on radios or newspapers or things like that. People started coming in. We were getting a lot of help from lawyers, doctors. But in a center like that, there was no proper assessment of your mental or physical health. They do have fulfilled all the what do you say, obligations, that there is a psychologist visiting. There is an organization called Foundation House. One of their psychologists will come, volunteer or involuntary or paid, I don't know. But those were the people they will make a report. And if that person is on your side, he writes a report, you get better treatment or sometime get out. In my case, it didn't happen. And I knew that, you know, when you start thinking, you know, the life is not worth living, or, you know, what has happened to your whole family or the life you have had in the past, and there is no hope, and when you're told that you will never be given a visa or something, or you're putting it up, you know, we are very strict about it, and you lose hope for life, you lose life. I was very, very extremely lucky that I had some big names, QCs and barristers used to visit and in contact. So we were able to go to the federal court asking for an independent psychiatric assessment, which took place. And in that they found that, you know, I am in a bad way. Psychologically, and that has to happen. Someone who is in detention, they can't even get a lawyer, and in a very stroke of luck, you know, that you have some connections, that you have some big people, they can take your case to the federal court, and then you get out. So I get out on a psychological or disturbance or psychiatric assessment based. After coming out, you know, there was a year and a half, I was placed on a bridging visa E, that I'm not allowed to work, not allowed to engage in education, not allowed to do even volunteer work. So I was placed in a perfect way of where you are. You are just a beggar that you have to ask everything, you know, food, water, or medicine, or clothing, or accommodation. So there were charity organizations, they helped. How that works, I'm not going to go into detail. It's all very injuring stuff, you know. When you lose your self-esteem as a person, self-respect as a person, you start expecting that some other people will give me and I'll lead. I have a family which is totally demolished with all those kind of stuff. Maybe a year and a half later, my visa application got accepted. Once that happened, you know, okay, you put on a new start allowance, had no information about, you know, that I am this and I can get any help. I was expected to work, and I wanted to work. I tried everywhere. The system is set up in a way that everybody, wherever you go, oh, this is your case officer, come, say how many hours or you worked or how many applications you applied, where you applied, and bang, you go there every couple of weeks. You fill the forms, the person sets and puts the data into the computer, and you go. The similar thing happened, you know, I worked for a couple of years on and off, odd jobs, whatever I was able to. I couldn't do anything. And then I have had this episodes of time where I will be on crutches or be completely on floor crawling. I have had all kind of proofs, MRIs, X-rays, CT scans, confirming that I've got these injuries. I got in detention 2001, early 2001. The people, generally the Australian public, how and why they must be I don't know, maybe not able to understand what happens to people in detention centers. You see, people are trying to kill themselves every day, breaking glasses, holding glasses, trying to cut themselves, slash themselves, drinking detergents and all these kind of things, losing hope, or running from 10 meters, running into walls, falling down, or things like that. You witness that every day with the children and women, young and old, everybody around, sick. People have, somebody was having a heart arrest, or, you know, cardiac arrest, and the ordinary guards are coming, oh, are you putting it on? And the other one will come and say, oh, maybe there is something serious. Oh, give him some Panadol or something. And then, you know, we'll be yelling and asking them, and some operation manager will come after 20 minutes of cardiac arrest. Luckily, person didn't die. But then they will take them in their ordinary sedan car to a hospital, only to be told by hospitals that, you know, this guy is having a cardiac arrest and you are bringing this person into a sedan car. It's wrong. Or if you're holding 100 people and you don't have, you have to, you should be, I don't know what law says, you should have an ambulance there when the circumstances are that people are trying to cut themselves or kill themselves. Well, there is no such facility. And if you witness these kind of things for a prolonged time, it ought to damage you psychologically. I would quote Professor Patrick McGorry. I and him had a little chance speaking at Melbourne University at some stage. And he quoted and said, detention centers are factories which produces the mental illness. There's a report from United Nations Human Rights Commission that they found, their finding was that people are in gross depression. Australian Human Rights Commission's findings, Amnesty International's findings, yeah, there are reports after reports, inquiries after inquiries. But system works like that. Once you're out, you're out. I applied for, you know, with all the documents or evidences I have for a disability pension. It was like 1 year was still, you know, the decision is coming, the decision come. Okay, now the finding is not good. So, okay, what do you want? So have a review. Okay, we'll review. The year is passed. Another year is, oh, the review says that, you know, maybe this year you pass like that and we'll see what we can do. Nothing happened. And I was transferred from one service provider to other service provider. With 2 years' time, you know, they want you to work. Yeah, I would want to work if I could be accepted or within my capacity. But that's not the case. You know, you have the reports, you can't do work, and they can't do anything. So I'll go there, they'll fill the data and go. After 2 years, they transfer me to the other one, to the other one. Didn't work. And I have to then again apply. And with more reports from the specialists, psychologists, GPs, neurosurgeons, you know, everybody who's engaged in rehabilitation or somehow to keep you afloat alive. And then that was also, the finding was again after 3 to 6 months that, you know, I'm not eligible. I said, okay, I'll go into the, now I will go into the internal review, and if that doesn't find out, then I'll go to the other legal ways to get some relief. So that's when I was given, so maybe a total 5 years of struggle to even get accepted as, yes, yeah, your injuries are genuine, and you don't need to look for work, or, you know, that you have to be cared or given as disability pension. So that's where I am.
Finally, here is a Tamil refugee talking about the impact of visa restrictions on him as a person with disabilities. His words here are being spoken by an interpreter.
In 2012, I came to Australia asking asylum in this country. He was included into the society by giving me a bridging visa in 2013. In 2016, I submitted my application through an attorney for asylum in this country to the immigration department. In April 2017, after examining my application, I was given safe haven visa. According to that visa, it is called safe enterprise haven visa. A person who gets that visa should live in a regional area for 3.5 years, 42 months, and the person who gets it should be able to be engaged in employment, studies, or employment studies?
Working.
Under that condition, I moved to the place where I am living in that regional area under that condition. Because of the defect in my because of albinism, I was not able to get a job in any of the employment, and because of that, I am at the moment studying in a TAFE college English language class. The problem with me is with albinism and my. My eyesight weakness also is the reason for me to find a suitable job. Because of this disability, I am not in a position to do a normal work. I am getting Centrelink benefit payment. That is also with a great difficulty because I have to report to the Centrelink office every 2 weeks. And every 3 months, it is reviewed by the department and the Centrelink department. What I am trying to say is, because of the disability, still the disabled people are treated as second class. Especially the charitable organizations like Salvation Army, and
Red Cross
and all that, they also don't provide much service to disabled people like us. Albinism, usually people get it because of some deficiency in melanin that gives a different color to the body and the eyesight also is reduced. Because of this deficiency, I won't be look at sunlight directly. And even in the night, I find it difficult to look at the lights. I got the contact of albinism and from Albinism Australia, and I spoke to that lady from that organization. They took my email address and the phone number and told me that they are going to have a conference and they will be contact me later on. I was not informed about the conference, but as well, they didn't make any arrangements for me to go for the conference. In my area where I live, there are two small boys who has also albinism. They belong to the Australian community. I had contacts with them within a short time. The boy's mother told me they had a conference in Adelaide and we went for that. Now, when I contacted Chandra from Albinism Australia, she said she was attending the conference in Adelaide at that moment. When she comes to my region, she will be contacting me. She never contacted me after coming there, but I myself contacted her later on. When I contacted her, she asked me to join an online group by paying $40. So I told her that I like to meet you personally. So can you give me an appointment to see you? And she never gave me that appointment. I was not in good in English. Because of that, I contacted a person from APN, that APN where I go for my English classes. And I asked that lady to explain things properly. Then only she told me our group doesn't do much work for anyone. So, so she told me that they don't do much work. They have only the conference every 2 years. And she said it will be a waste for you to join the conference. So I just gave it up. My understanding and what I want to know is that when there is a support, there is support from UN for albinism people, and specifically they are having a day for albinism day, and what is the point in having all these things when they are not doing anything to us? During the time I was in Victoria, Vision Australia helped me, and I the only help I got it here was the transport facility to travel in train, tram and bus. In the regional areas, Vision of Australia office is there, but they don't work as the way the Vision Australia office work in the cities, you see. Especially when I ask for, they are understaffed as well. When I ask for this white stick, they, so many times I have to request them for that. After repeated calls only, finally, a lady gave it to me. And I have never seen that lady after that because they are so understaffed there. In my regional office, they have a sub-office. They have their head office in Ballarat, which is far away from my place where I stay. In 2018, she contacted me once, and she wanted to see me. And when I told her about the appointment date, I got another appointment. Since then, I have never seen her. Otherwise, when I visit that sub-office, no, I don't see anyone there in that office. When I was in Melbourne, they supported me very well. But regional office, they said, sorry, we don't have any staff here. It is very difficult for us to. I am living in a regional area. The reason is, according to the condition of the issuance of the visa, we are supposed to live in that area for 42 months. You would have known recently that the immigration department is very harshly implementing the policies because of the population burst in the city areas. They want more people to move to the regional areas. I am happy about you are interviewing me about during this disability week because this should bring awareness in the society.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Power from the Margins, 3CR's Disability Day broadcast. You've just listened to Ableism in the Settler Colony. To support the work of RISE and to donate, you can visit their website, riserefugee.org. I'm Pauline Vatuna. Thank you for listening.